Blog Talk Radio.
Good day, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio's live broadcast and podcast here on Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. As we've been discussing for a few months now, these shows represent our desire to explore a variety of issues and events that help shape and comment on the current revolution in longevity and how that revolution is impacting our families, ourselves, and our Jewish world at large. And we invite you to share your comments with us at Rabbi Address at JewishSacredAging.com or on the Jewish Sacred Aging Radio Facebook page. And today, we are very, very pleased to welcome the editor-in-chief of Shema, a journal of Jewish sensibilities. Welcome Susan Berin, all the way from beautiful Berkeley, California. Hi, Susan. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's great. How's Berkeley today?
Berkeley is beautiful. It's only 8 in the morning here, so it hasn't started yet, but it looks like it's going to be a gorgeous day.
Well, good. Enjoy the coffee I hope you're having, and welcome. I want to talk to you about Shema, and the first question I have to ask you is really the tagline on Shema, the Journal of Jewish Sensibilities. What do you mean by that?
Well, Jewish sensibilities are big universal themes with a Jewish lens. So every month a sensibility informs the type of issue that we're going to do. So we've done, for instance, mezuzah. The last two issues, January and February, were both on mezuzot. One of them, looking at the January issue, looking at the idea of a mezuzah as a threshold, as that liminal space between inside and outside, or between here and there, liminal time. And the February issue looked at mezuzot as reminders. You know, every time we pass a mezuzah, what do we think about? We're reminded of what's inside of it, the Shema. And so it's looking at big universal topics through a particularly Jewish sensibility.
And the articles cover a whole variety of a menu of issues and emotions and really generations. Much of the material in these works really impact and speak to baby boomers. How do you decide on an issue and the approach? I mean, like you said, the last two issues on mezuzot, many people would say, well, it's you know, we hang it on our doorpost because we're supposed to, but you've reached in there and from a variety of different perspectives in these last issues and really mine some of the symbolism of this. How do you decide on these issues month to month?
Well, I try to think about both broad interest, what people are interested in talking about, what I want to live with and think about myself personally and professionally for several months. The issue takes about 5 months to put together, and it comes out monthly inside the foreword, the print magazine of the foreword, as an insert, and it's posted online. And so I have to really be really interested in a topic. And then once I choose a topic, and sometimes I really try to have that it talks to the moment. So, for instance, I'm thinking now about the upcoming topics for the fall. And so our Rosh Hashanah issue, for example, we're going to be looking at the idea of judgment and deen. And I think that that'll be an important topic, not only where the Jewish community is in terms of reflecting on the high holidays, but also where the world is and where the Jews living in America are thinking about. And then I'm also thinking about doing an issue for the November elections on voting rights. And again, so some of the topics are more informed by the Jewishness of them and where we are in the Jewish calendar, and some are more informed where we are in the secular calendar.
But each issue, no matter where it starts at, if I'm not mistaken, approaches or embraces a Jewish tom, a Jewish approach, a text.
Yes,
if I'm not mistaken. Right. Go ahead.
Not only does it approach it as a Jewish text or a Jewish story, but it also approaches it through the lens of Elu ve'Elu. These and these are the words of the living God. And so in every issue, we really try to bring in different perspectives. The Shema is now 4 pages. And so in 4 pages, we generally have 4 articles. And our simulated Talmud page, we call it Nishma. And that Nishma has in the center of that page, we have a verse, usually from Talmud or a Midrash or Mishnah, something. And then I send that out to 3 people, and they try to explicate that verse both personally and textually. So it makes a great teaching tool for rabbis. It makes a very lively and dynamic page. And it's really core to what we are at Shema, is bringing people together to talk on our pages that might not sit down at a table together.
Mm-hmm. What brought you to Shema? What motivated you to go in this direction and be the editor in chief of this enterprise?
Well, in 1998 I was moving to Boston and from Victoria, British Columbia, where I had lived for 16 years, and I was looking for a job. And one of the things that I really loved is putting together people and ideas. And I had edited two collections, one on Rosh Chodesh that was published by Jason Aronson Press, and one on Jewish Thoughts on Aging. And that's, I think, where you and I first met through
that
book. And that was published by Jewish Lights. And what I've always really loved to do is, like, be a shadchanit. Think about, like, what I want to be talking about and having a conversation about, and who are the people that I'd like to invite into my living room to talk to me about those things. And I met Yossi Abramowitz, who at that time was acquiring Shema from Klal, who had published Shema for 4 years or 5 years after Eugene Borowitz decided he wanted to retire from Shema, although he continued to teach, of course, at HUC for many years thereafter. I met Yossi, and I spoke with him kind of about my philosophy about how I saw Shema, and I had edited an issue of it on aging a couple of years earlier when Nina Beth Carden was editor. And he said, okay, let's make this happen. And we started working together, and we worked together for about 10 years until Yossi made Aliyah and moved to Israel, and then Shema was acquired by the Lippman Kanfer Foundation for Living Torah, and they created the Shema Institute as the umbrella to hold Shema.
And let's go the access of this. You mentioned before this is now. Because I remember Shema at the beginning, it was you had to subscribe to it. Came, it was a gray newsprint type of thing. It's now included on a monthly basis in the foreword. Somebody wants to get a hold of it. Can they download this from the foreword? Can they subscribe to Shema specifically? How does one access Shema now?
Right. Well, the Shema is printed every month as an insert in the foreword. And in addition, so one can get the hard copy by subscribing to the foreword. And I think that they have a senior rate. I don't know what the subscription rate is, but it's, I think, pretty reasonable. And then we can also download the PDF of the issue or read individual essays on the foreword's website. We have a special channel on the foreword's website.
Which is what? which is
forward.com/SHMA-NOW. So forward.com/SHMA-NOW. And it's all free. And if you sign up for our newsletter, you get an email just once a month telling you when the new issue is out.
Talk to me a little bit about, you've been editing, you've been editor-in-chief now for how many years?
Since 1998, so 18 years. It's my high year.
Mazel tov. And no, sir, that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. They should throw you a party. And you've been involved, as you've been saying, I've been talking about this for other years and in and out and involved with Shema and writing and editing. You now look at these articles that have come in these last 18 years. Talk to me a little about what's changed. What's changed in the nature of the articles? What's changed in the nature of how Shema represents, to use your line, the sensibilities of the American Jewish community? What have you noticed?
Well, one thing that's very obvious, which isn't really addressing your question, is that people read shorter articles now. And so while long-form journalism has a wonderful place in our canon, and several online magazines still do publish long-form journalism, our articles are pretty short, crisp, and to the point. And so that we've really tried to take in the changing way that people access information, and not only, you know, what they read, but how they read it. But to your question about how the articles have changed, in some ways, I don't think the articles have changed all that much. I think that we're still a very curious people. I think that, in general, the American public goes to read things that they already agree with. We live more in a bubble than we used to. But I think we're still curious. Jews are curious about ideas, and we're drawn to look at an array of ideas. And I hope that that continues. I think it's really fundamental to a robust civic society. And so we are very committed to publishing an array of ideas on each topic. And, you know, so for instance, we like to kind of disrupt what might be expected. When I'm trying to put together an issue, I think a great deal about what four essays I want to appear and who I want to include as my writers. And that really, to me, is the most creative aspect of what I do. So, for instance, I'm in April, we're publishing an issue on Shalom Bayit and, you know, the idea of peace in the home. And so our lead-off essay is looking, you know, at what are textual sources that inspire and give us the grounding to speak about Shalom Bayit. Deborah Rosenblum, who works for Jewish Women's International and who have done a lot of work in domestic abuse in the Jewish community, she wrote our lead piece, and she talks about Abraham and Sarah as the kind of founding Jewish couple. And she walks our readers through what to expect when looking at this topic of peace in the home and what disrupts that. And then we have Nancy Aiken, who works in Baltimore with an organization called Chana, and it's a Jewish response to abuse and trauma. And she gives us some very specific case studies of Jews and how they and tries to disrupt the idea that domestic violence doesn't happen in the Jewish community. And she gives some specific examples, of course, without naming specific people. And then we have Israel Heller, who writes about his own family and how he disrupted the Shalom Bayit of his home by leaving the ultra-Orthodox community. And finally, we have Jane Kanarek, a rabbi who teaches at Hebrew College at their rabbinical school, and she writes a beautiful essay looking at the Talmudic sense of how a woman is portrayed in the Talmud as the house. Isha is another word for using the word bayit, home. So, you know, we try to amplify the idea of Shalom Bayit and also disrupt it a little bit. Just say, okay, let's poke some holes in this and what we're thinking about.
We're talking with Susan Barron, the editor-in-chief of Shema Magazine, the Journal of Jewish Sensibilities, here on today's edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. Susan, have you looked at the demographics? Who's reading Shema? Is it multi-generational? Does it skew more to 50-plus? Have you looked at that?
I think it's changing. When we when we went into our partnership with the Forward, our readership was skewing 50-plus and heavily professional Jews, educators, rabbis, people, federation directors, people who work in the Jewish community. And that really makes sense. A lot of people began subscribing in the 70s when Eugene Borowitz founded Shema and never let go. Since we've been partnering with the Forward and since we're online, I've asked the Forward about that, and they have a much broader audience than we have. They have about 35,000 subscribers, and online they get 1 million unique visitors each month, I think. I'm not a tech person particularly, so the number
Welcome
is
to the club.
Yeah, so I don't really know exactly the numbers, but it was and they've surveyed their online readers to see and they're getting I think 30% of their readership is now 30 and 50 years old.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And are you getting any reaction from that, from the Gen X or even millennials vis-a-vis the types of articles? Because even in this last issue, the symbolism of the mezuzah and this article by a colleague on, you know, when rabbis themselves have to go through issues of loss or grief, et cetera, and what that does. I mean, again, it's the symbolism of this article, the mezuzah, but a lot of the writers themselves, I think, are beginning to, as I've looked at the last several issues, trend into the Gen X crowd. And I would imagine you're doing this because this is where a lot of the creativity and the millennials are coming from.
Well, I think we're all very creative, but I think that younger people share their work in different ways. And they have some ideas that, you know, we haven't thought about yet. But I do reach out to younger writers, and I don't have a staple of writers. I don't have, like, a core group of people that I go to over and over again to write for Shema. Every single issue, I start with a blank slate and decide what types of questions are going to inform that issue? What types of questions do I ask when I think about this issue? And who can amplify those kinds of questions? So, for instance, in this issue on reminders, Rabbi Dan Goldblatt wrote the piece that you refer to about the pain of losing his wife. And I asked him to write about that because I was really interested in the question about how are we reminded of things? And are there times when we don't want to be reminded? So I asked him to look into that question. And I also asked Rabbi Aryeh Ben-David to think about pain as a reminder. And he wrote a wonderful piece on toxic stones, like stones around our heart that really remind us that we need to make changes in our lives, or think about things in different ways, or attend to ourselves without just ignoring certain, you know, things that have become routine. And then I asked Jeffrey Chandler, who's he teaches at Rutgers University, and he's a Holocaust scholar. And I was really interested because when I started to think about this issue was the time, it was last fall when there was a lot of conversation about the monuments to Confederate soldiers and what should happen with them. So I wanted him to write about that, about how as Jews we've dealt with monuments. How do we hold on to reminders of the Holocaust? When is it time to let go of things? And how is it best, how do we use reminders as educational opportunities rather than just as, you know, a statue in a park that we walk right past?
Mm-hmm. How do you find the authors? I mean, the way you've described it and putting an issue together, you sort of like sit down with yourself and your soul and say, what are the questions that I would like to ask about a particular subject? But then how do you reach out? How do you get these authors? You have this huge Rolodex or spreadsheet, or you go to people that you know, your board, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, I have a very wonderful advisory board, and we meet once a month by conference call and once every couple of months, whenever I'm starting to frame a new issue. Mm-hmm. And I really thank them for making each issue as diverse as it is. So I'm going to actually name them because they're wonderful people. And I'm sure you probably know a few of them. Rabbi Richard Hirsch, who's been on my advisory board probably for a dozen years, and is such a wonderful contributor to our issue, and to every issue. Rachel Brody, who's an educator here in Berkeley and a very creative thinker. Rabbi Jill Jacobs, who is the executive director of TRUA, a rabbinic call for justice. Ari Kelman, who is a professor of Jewish education at Stanford. Shaul Magid, who is a professor of Jewish thought at Indiana University. Rabbi Lee Moore, who worked for the foundation of the Lippman Canfer Foundation for Living Torah. Rabbi Danya Rutenberg, who works with Avodah, the Service Corps. And Bobby Saferstein, who is a social media and tech person and helps us greatly try to figure out how we get our news and material out into the world. And I've just invited two new people to join the board, and I cycle people on and off of the board every few years so that we continue to have really robust thinking. And so we have Rabbi Avi Killup, who works at Machon Hadar, and Joshua Feldman, who works at Hillel International, developing, he works with a new initiative to develop a pipeline for Jewish professionals.
Susan, where do you want to take Shimon the next 5 years? What is the vision moving forward?
Well, I'm really, I'm very concerned about people living in their bubbles. Of course, I'm saying that from my perch in my office in Berkeley, California, which is a bubble in itself. But I try to read broadly. I read a lot of magazines. I read a lot online. I listen to a lot of different kinds of podcasts. And I think that to really be informed, civic-minded Jews in America or, you know, across the globe, we really have to continue to listen and hear. Shema means to listen deeply. And that is really my vision, is to help people and to provide a foundation that people can come to the magazine to read what they might not read elsewhere. So we might cover a topic that someone has read in another magazine, but we cover it in a different way, and we've tried to bring in voices that don't always appear together. And I'm concerned about the lack of that ELU-va-ELU stance, the lack of really trying to wrestle with different opposing ideas, which is part of our Talmudic foundation in our history.
The American society is increasingly polarized or siloed, to really use your image. Do you see this beginning or existing right now in the American Jewish community, which seems to be undergoing such really amazing changes and restructuring? Do you see this siloing really existing now in our community, or do you see actually the breaking down of these silos and greater interaction?
I think I probably see both of those things happening. I do see a more rigid lines between, let's say, the ultra-Orthodox community and the rest of the religious-leaning people, Jews. I think that there is more polarization in some regards, and yet on the same hand, you know, or a different hand, I think there's a post-denominational vibrancy. We have now two rabbinical schools, both the Academy of Jewish Religion and Hebrew College, maybe others, that are non-denominational settings to train rabbis and to train leaders. And I think so many of the indie minyanim, the independent startup minions and other Jewish startups. Here in Berkeley, we have so many Jewish startups, one for farming, one for experiencing Judaism in the wilderness, one for experiencing Judaism through artistic expression. And these are national organizations that happen to be housed here in Berkeley. They're absolutely non-denominational. They reach out. I was just at a program last night at the Jewish Studio Project, which is this wonderful startup that explores Judaism through artistic expression. We saw film clips of a Jewish woman filmmaker, and she spoke about it. And there were people all ages in the room, all denominations, completely open. So I think both things are happening simultaneously.
The independent, the independent minyanim, the post-denominational surge wave right now that we're experiencing. Do you see this as a fad, or do you really see this as this is going to be an amazing part? This is now part of the established Jewish community. This non-denominational, post-denominational, whatever you want to call it, world. Is it here to stay?
I think it's here to stay. Yeah, I don't know what it will morph into, and I think it's a period of great flux. And, you know, whenever something is on a very dynamic trajectory, we don't know where it's headed, but I don't think that the independent minyanim that are non-denominational will ever join a religious movement. Their success is really that they reach out to a broad spectrum of people that are really happy to be in a davening together. They find some common ground, and they really are enjoying that non-movement experience.
No, I agree with you. I think it's part of what we refer to in some of the workshops we do at Jewish Sacred Aging as the creation of a new American Judaism. And I think we're really on the cusp. We're not on the cusp. We're in the middle of it. And
yeah.
I think it's exciting. It's dynamic. It's multi-generational. It's non-denominational. And it's kind of very interesting to go around the country and see what's happening in very tremendous amount of creativity. I think perhaps this may be one of the most creative moments in American Jewish history. It's just being done very, very differently than it was many years ago when I was a young rabbi in a galaxy very far away. Susan Baron, the editor-in-chief of Shema, the Journal of Jewish Sensibilities. In the minute we have left, Susan, once again, I want to get a hold of Shema. How do I do that?
The easiest way is to go on the website, forward.com/SHMA-NOW. Shema Now. Thanks so much.
And it's also, we want to remind people, for those people who do have access to the print edition of the Foreword out of New York, it's published monthly as an insert in the Foreword. Does it come out at the beginning of the month, middle of the month, end of the month, Susan?
Usually the beginning of the month.
Okay. Again, Susan, thank you very, very much. A continued success. Good luck. We look forward to reading more from Shema and letting us know on Jewish Sacred Aging upcoming edition. So take care. Enjoy the day in Berkeley. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Rich. Bye-bye.
Bill, bye-bye. We'll be right back with our next guest, Corinne Carey from Compassion and Choices. Take a little break.
Turn your podcasting passion into profits. The book, The Business of Podcasting, describes the business side of podcasting, including how to become a professional podcaster. You'll learn about positioning your clients' expertise through podcasting, too, plus the best business models, how to find clients, and much more. Visit thebusinessofpodcasting.com.
One of the most interesting and challenging ideas now making its way through states in the United States of America and other countries, as a matter of fact, is what we'll call legislation legalizing choice in dying. The organization that has really been a pioneer in this is something called Compassion and Choices, and we've invited for an update on this very timely and somewhat controversial movement representative from Compassion and Choices, Corinne. Corinne, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks so much for having me.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm good, and yourself?
Hang it in. Can't complain. Spring training starting this week, so, you know, truth returns to America. And the Eagles won the Super Bowl, so for those of us in Philadelphia, it's a good start of the year so far. Anyway,
I lived in Philly for a while. Go Eagles.
Oh, you know. You know. Compassion and Choices, Corinne. Just give me a brief overview. What is Compassion and Choices?
Compassion and Choices is the nation's oldest, largest, and most active organization working to improve choice and care at the end of life. So we work in the courts, in the legislatures across the country, and with families to make sure that people have access to information and to the choices that they need to make at the end of life.
Let's deal with some of the controversy. First of all, currently there are, I think, 5 states or 7 states in the district that have passed legislation on choice in dying. It's 5 or 7. Where am I?
It's 6 states and Washington, D.C., starting with Oregon in 1994, with the latest being Colorado by ballot initiative in 2016, and also the Washington, D.C. City Council made the option legal for residents of D.C. in 2016 as well.
The greatest attack on choice is this is assisted suicide. Talk to me about this approach, because I know it appears in the media all the time.
Yeah, I think our opponents do use the word suicide. I think it's used as a scare tactic Suicide conjures this image of trauma to a family. And what we know is that people who choose medical aid in dying are anything but suicidal. You know, someone who is suicidal is choosing death over life. People who want medical aid in dying want nothing more than to continue to live. Their disease is taking that option away from them. And so what they want is more control over the circumstances and the manner of their death. You know, the American Association for Suicidology, it sounds like a name that you may not have heard of, but they really are the leading experts in suicide prevention across the country. They issued several months ago 15 reasons why medical aid in dying is distinguishable from suicide. But I think we don't just have to take it from the experts. You know, you talk to people who are living with terminal illness, and they are, I have to say, some people that are the most full of life. They're people who want to, you know, leave with the same kind of beautiful ritual for their families as we greet birth with. They want to gather their friends around them and say goodbye and die peacefully. That is not a suicide.
The concept of choice, I think, and when I have come up to this in workshops that we do on end-of-life decision-making in Jewish sacred aging, we always come to talk about the idea of choice and giving an individual in this day and age the opportunity to make choices based upon their own soul, their own psyche, their own context, their own circumstance. You've run into, however, I would imagine, various religious concerns against this legislation, saying this is really life and death belongs to a higher power. How much involvement in this dialogue and debate has Compassionate Choices been?
Well, the organization has certainly come across this opposition in every state that we work in. But personally, it was my first test on this job when I started 3 years ago. I'm Catholic, raised Catholic. I'm a practicing Catholic. And my first stop was to my mother to ask for her blessing to apply for this job. And the first thing she said was, go talk to your priest. He'll tell you why we're against this. And I said to her, you know, Mom, medical aid in dying may not have been the choice for my dad when he passed, you know, the year before I took this job. It may not be the choice for you and for me, but religious freedom in this country actually means that we all get to make our own choices based on our own faith and values and beliefs, and we can't dictate those choices to other people. And I think she got it. But I think the next thing that I said, which is, you know, I don't eat meat on Fridays, and it's not because the state tells me not to. It's because my God and my faith and my culture tell me not to. I don't need a state law for that. And so if we truly believe that as people of faith, for example, if one is a person of faith, that we get to make our own decisions, God has given us the free will to make those decisions, it shouldn't be the state telling us not to, and it certainly shouldn't be the state imposing someone else's religious beliefs on the rest of the state.
Corinne, how important in working with families and individuals is really taking the time with a family or with a religious leader to really talk about making decisions? What do I want? This is what I want. I've thought about this. How important is that conversation?
I think it's critical. I think for many people, when they receive a critical or a terminal diagnosis, they feel like they're on an assembly line, that there really are no choices, that the medical establishment is making all of the choices for them. And so empowering people to have the conversation about what they want, what kind of care they want, what kind of care they may not want at the end of life is really important. It's important for people to talk to their families, and it's important for people to talk to providers. And what we've heard from doctors in states where medical aid in dying is authorized is that once you open up that conversation and allow people to talk, they are choosing hospice. They are choosing palliative care. They are choosing, sometimes they're choosing experimental treatments and clinical trials because they know in these authorized states that they have the option to ask for medical aid in dying if things become too hard. And so we're actually seeing people having conversations about making really difficult choices that involve prolonging life so long as they know that there's this option to allow them a peaceful death at the end. So the conversations couldn't be more important at this point in our society, but also in states that authorize medical aid in dying.
I'm sure you've studied, and I think you have statistics on the fact that in these states that have passed this legislation, there is no, again, no rush for people to, you know, quote, qualify. It, my experience in some families, it's almost like a comfort that I know I have this choice available to me, but life still is paramount. Have you seen this statistically, that people don't rush to access or qualify, but are comforted in the sense that they know they have this option available to them?
You're absolutely right. In the 20 years that Oregon has had a medical aid in dying law, only about 1,700 people have gotten the prescription, and that's over 20 years. More than a third of them end up never taking the medication, and their families report exactly as you said, you know, that people feel like once they have the medication in hand, once they can put it in the medicine cabinet, they then can focus on living. And many people, you know, experience this sense of relief, and they go on to do things that they want to do at the end of their life, travels, you know, having meaningful time with family and friends. You know, people are not in a rush to get this medication. I think it's just a comfort. We had a Compassion and Choices was involved in a legislative hearing in California on the year anniversary that law took effect. So doctors, patients, family members all came to tell lawmakers what their experience has been, and family member after family member described the sense of relief that someone got once they had that medication in their hands.
Does Compassion and Choices work with palliative care groups? Because it would seem to me that this would be a natural liaison in many ways.
Absolutely. I mean, in the authorized states, we certainly work with those groups. We work on best practices for people that are receiving both palliative care and have asked for medical aid in dying. And that, by the way, is the vast majority of people. Over 90% of the people who end up using medical aid in dying are already receiving hospice and palliative care. And to them and to their providers, medical aid in dying is seen as an extension of that care, not an alternative to, but an additional tool at the very end for people who want to avoid unnecessary suffering. In unauthorized states like New York, like New Jersey, we understand that there's a real gap in knowledge, a real gap in acceptance around hospice and palliative care. And so whenever we go out into the community to talk about end-of-life choices, we highlight what it means, what hospice and palliative care mean, what those services do to benefit patients and their families. And I think that by talking about expanding choice at the end of life, we're really breathing life into the dialogue around these other choices that are really underutilized.
Why do you think so many people are afraid of this?
Well, I think people are afraid of death and dying. I think that we're really seeing a shift in our society right now. I think it started maybe with Atul Gawande's book Being Mortal, and then his Frontline series, highlighting some stories that he tells in the book. Maybe it has been young people gathering together with death cafes. Maybe it's, folks on the West Coast with the death positive movement trying to get people to see the importance of ritual around death. But we really are at a turning point in our country. For too long, I think we've we've denied that there is, you know, that with all of our medical advances, that there couldn't be a cure for mortality, but there isn't. We all struggle with it. We all deal with it. We all experience it in our own lives. And I think once you start to have those conversations, whether it's in your own family about advanced planning directives to make sure that you're getting the care that you want and deserve at the end of life, even when you can no longer voice your preferences, I think that those conversations are taking away some of the stigma. And the stories that are coming out of California and from Oregon and from Colorado about people, you know, gathering their loved ones and really having a beautiful ceremony to say goodbye to a well-lived life, I think that those stories are resonating, and our feelings about death and dying are hopefully changing in this country.
Well, I know one of the workshops that we do in Jewish Sacred Aging deals with new rituals for new life stages, and just in our little collection, we've seen a rise in colleagues, rabbis, and even lay people really creating some beautiful end-of-life rituals and celebrations of life rituals and even rituals and prayers when removing life support. So I know that this is the beginning. Do you sense, before we start running out of time for this segment, there's a generational shift? Do you see this acceptance cross generationally or more skewed towards, let's say, millennials more accepting as opposed to boomers? Although I would assume that a lot of boomers that I run into are very, very much in favor of medical aid or choice in dying legislation.
They are. I think the statistics show that the baby boomer generation is very much in favor of taking control of their own death process. They've watched their parents die. They've watched their parents die, importantly, at a time when medical technology is keeping people alive well past a stage that they ever were before. And I think that's creating more problems and more suffering for people. And so that generation is witnessing it. I think that across generations we're seeing this. You know, I just think about my own family, and my aunt and my cousin were in a book club reading Dr. Atul Gawande's Being Mortal, and they had that discussion. Two different generations, but those sentiments around death and dying really resonate for every generation once you really dig deep and start to talk about the issue.
Corinne Carey from Compassion and Choices, we're just about out of time, so one last real question. If somebody wants to get involved or touch base with the organization, how do they do that? What's the website?
The website is www.compassionandchoices.org, or you could just Google Compassion and Choices and you'll find us right away.
And how many states are pending legislation right now?
25 states are looking at passing legislation, and we're very hopeful for some states on the East Coast this year.
Yeah, I know my state of New Jersey is, with the new governor, may try to, because the bill got stuck somewhere. So we're hoping. Anyway, Corinne Carey, thank you very, very much for updating us on this very, very timely, very, very important, and very, very real issue of medical aid in dying, choice in dying, where we stand on this legislatively, and continued good luck, and thank you for joining us here on today's edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. Take care. One of the ongoing features here on a regular basis of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio is our colleague Rabbi Jeff Salkin and his commentary on My Theological Clock is Ticking. And we welcome Jeff to our show today with his latest edition of My Theological Clock is Ticking. Take it away, Rabbi Salkin.
Hi, I'm Rabbi Jeff Salkin. Welcome back to another installment of My Theological Clock is Ticking. In this series, we talk about some of the moments that created our lives as we were growing up and what those moments have to say to us. I'm going to start actually by bringing us back 50 years ago. If you were alive and conscious 50 years ago, and especially if you lived in the New York area, you will have remembered the infamous, or famous as it were, New York City school teachers strike. Now, what provoked that moment? It was provoked by the decentralization of New York City schools, and that meant that local communities could create their own school boards. And so there's an area in Brooklyn called Ocean Hill-Brownsville, and in that area, a group of teachers were fired, and many of them were Jewish. And that was the action that provoked the teachers' strike. And it also provoked a confrontation between blacks and Jews that has left enduring scars. But the real purpose of me telling you about this is to talk about a man who died just the other day. And that's Julius Lester. Julius Lester was a black radical. And he hosted a radio show on New York's independent radio station, WBAI. And during the school strike, he invited a black administrator to speak on the show. The administrator read a poem that was written by a black child. "Hey, Jew boy, with that yarmulke on your head, you pale-faced Jew boy, I wish you were dead." Pretty nice, huh? And so there was a backlash that came, and it was fast and furious. And Julius Lester defended his choice to air that vile piece of literature. He said that we needed to hear how the strike had affected black children. Fast forward. Julius Lester remembered something that he had known since he was a child, that he had a German-Jewish ancestor. And that memory, and perhaps also the backlash over the anti-Semitic poem that he aired, pushed him into an encounter with his Jewish family background. Fast forward, Julius Lester joined the Jewish people. And you can read about it in his autobiography, which is called Love Song. He taught in both the Black Studies program and the Jewish Studies programs at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, Massachusetts. He also served as the lay leader of the Bethel Synagogue in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Now, this is a sweet coincidence. That was my first student pulpit when I was a rabbinical student. Julius was a musician as well. He had an amazing voice. The most beautiful rendition of Yigdal I ever heard was the one that he sang at his old synagogue in Northampton, Massachusetts. So why do I tell you this story? There is a rumor in American culture that says that in life, there are no second acts. I beg to differ. Judaism believes that in life, there is always a second act and a third act. It has become a cliche, but sometimes cliches are real. What we do in our lives is we reinvent ourselves. The story of Julius Lester is an amazing story because it's a story of personal transformation. It is a story of spiritual growth. It is the story of how you can reclaim a family legacy. And it's the story of a man who had the inner strength to give that legacy both wings and music. I'm thinking about something that Julius Lester wrote about Pharaoh's daughter in the book of Exodus, who adopted Moses. He imagined that she was dissatisfied with the life and values that her father had bequeathed to her, and that she rebelled against his rule. He also said something that I think was intended for our time. Listen to this. When a group idealizes itself as the height of humanity, it automatically creates an other. And I think we have to understand that. What racism and anti-Semitism do, in the words of Julius Lester, is they satisfy a longing for coherence, for community, and for an ideal in the face of a changing world. To encounter those words after what happened in Charlottesville, Virginia, is really to shiver and tremble. But I'd like to end with the following line by Julius Lester that I've quoted every so often. It's when he says something about how the Jews have suffered. We Jews have taken our suffering and we have offered it to the world as a long-stemmed rose. Now, understand the image here. The rose is a thing of uncommon beauty, but the beauty conceals thorns. Julius Lester was saying that those who suffer have a moral obligation to make sure that they understand their suffering as a lesson to the world and also to themselves. It is a lesson that forbids silence in the face of oppression. Anything less is a mockery of that pain. Well, I started with the story of the New York City school teachers' strike. It's something that's about to mark its half-century milestone this year. There are many things that we will be noting in coming months. It will be the 50th anniversary of the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. It will be the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Senator Robert Kennedy. It will be the 50th anniversary of the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, which was torn apart by riots. These are events that created our lives, but I wanted you to hear about Julius Lester, because Julius Lester has a life lesson for all of us. No matter how old we are, we can reinvent ourselves, and we can view our lives as a work of art. Shalom. We'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you very much. And thank all of you for being part of today's broadcast of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. These shows are archived as podcasts on both Blog Talk Radio and our own website, www.jewishsacredaging.com. And again, we invite your comments and suggestions to rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. or to visit us on the Jewish Sacred Aging Radio Facebook page. These shows are produced at the studios of Lubeckin Global Media in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and we give thanks always to our producer, Steve Lubeckin. Thank you very, very much for listening to our show today with Susan Barron, the editor-in-chief of Shema Magazine, Corinne Carey from Compassion and Choices, and our regular commentary by Rabbi Jeff Salkin. We look forward to greeting you again on the next edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio here on Blog Talk Radio. And again, we invite you to always check our podcasts on the homepage of JewishSacredAging.com. Thank you again for listening. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. Take care. Have a great week, and shalom.